Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCB 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
For the interview today, we are going to be talking with true crime writer Paul Drexler, and we have a book in particular that he's focusing on called Notorious San Francisco, and it's True Tales of Crime, Passion, and Murder. So thank you for joining me, Paul.
Sure, it's wonderful to be here.
So, Paul, first of all, let's let the audience hear a little bit about you. What got you into writing true crime?
It's funny. I'm not sure. I think one might be in the 1950s. My uncle Jack's Buick was stolen and used in a gangland killing in New Jersey, and that definitely got my attention. And I think that's kind of how I got started on this. And I just find the history of crime and some of these things just fascinating. And they're also a lot of times related to other things that are going on around us. And they're just great stories. So that's kind of how I got started. I came out to San Francisco almost 40 years ago. And I've been sort of specializing in writing about the Bay Area crime.
You know, I find it's pretty interesting. Now, you particularly look at older crimes like Notorious San Francisco. So you're talking about things from way back, aren't you? Maybe give us a little brief of kind of what you focus on.
Oh, sure. Well, you know, San Francisco is a city that was founded in part by criminals. And that's one of the reasons that make it so interesting. So the crimes, I go back to, I'd say, the range of what I write about is between, say, 1850 and the early 1970s. And this is, you know, this is a city that likes weird things and it likes unusual people. So it's almost like asking for these the poet Kenneth Rexroth said that San Francisco is the only American city which was not founded by the westward spreading Puritan tradition. It was settled mostly by gamblers, prostitutes, rascals, immigrants, and fortune seekers. Those are my kind of people. So that interests me.
Oh, you hang out with those kind of people.
Yeah. And we're also a united nations of crime. I mean, really, all nationalities. In fact, in the early 1850s, the biggest group in San Francisco were the French. And they got here because there was this big lottery in Paris, which is called the Lottery of the Golden Ingot. And what the first prize was this huge hunk of gold. And what they said they were going to do with the money was to bring 5,000, you know, deserving poor French people to the United States. But what they actually did was they went into the prisons and they took the prostitutes, the pimps, and all their political opponents, put them on ships and sent them to California, where they fit right in. So it's got that kind of atmosphere to it.
Yeah, and San Francisco's seen a lot of crime and activity. Of course, you know, with the Zodiac coming up with the 50th mm-hmm. anniversary, that's, I'm sure, something you hear about a lot with San Francisco. And that seems to be an endless one.
it's so interesting. I do write about that. And it's, I really call it, it's a study of zodiology. Because what's fascinating, in addition to the crime, is the world of people who are studying the crime. And it has so many classic, you know, parts to it. You know, you have this murderer who you really can hate. You know, they're very obnoxious. They're very braggadocio. You really want them to be caught, and somehow they're not. And also, they have these ciphers that they put up, so it's an intellectual puzzle also. And yeah, it's almost like a religion, the zodiology business. And people have different suspects. It's like they're different kind of brands of the religion, and they argue endlessly about whether it's this person or that person. And I find those kinds of things interesting.
Yeah. If you've ever been on one of their Facebook groups or pages, I can't believe how I think they're probably one of the more hateful groups.
Oh, you're right. You know, well, it's. I think it's kind of like if you're like an extreme religious person, you hate the person who's slightly different from you much more than the person who doesn't believe at all. It's like those little differences. And yeah, and it is fascinating to read the vitriol that people throw at each other, and also some of the incredible theories. And this sort of gets into conspiracy theories also.
Yeah. Some of them get crazy. I mean, we've had people on say that was anywhere from Ted Kaczynski, the mm-hmm. Unabomber, to
right.
to Hodel's grandfather, and what is it about this crime, and what is it about a lot of different crimes that we see? Do you think that people want to believe it's their family members of some sort?
I mean,
that's crazy. Like, I couldn't. I didn't necessarily get along with my father. In fact, we probably didn't get along at all. But I couldn't turn around now and start saying, "Well, I think he was, you know, the whatever the Green River Killer."
Yeah. Like, right.
I mean, just
it is. It's very funny, and also. There was the more recent guy who wrote, you know, a pretty well-selling book about his father being the Zodiac. The only real evidence is that his father looked a lot like this guy. But he has this whole theory with handwriting, and they base the theory on the handwriting on a wedding certificate being the same as Zodiac's handwriting. And then it turns out that the person who has the handwriting on the wedding certificate was the minister who married them.
Well, that says it all. You know,
yeah. So maybe that guy is the Zodiac. I don't know.
Yeah. You know, and I kind of feel sorry. Sometimes when I'm interviewing people like that, I mean, that you kind of start thinking, wow, this they probably need help. And I just, you know, they're in a bad situation when they start thinking things like that. And I mean, if you find real evidence, you know, like, you know, clothing or body parts or something from a murder, then you can sort of start maybe taking it seriously. I don't know. It's too bad. I just
well,
don't know what it is.
Yeah. Well, it's also interesting when you look at evidence, and I've gotten more interested in this, what is good evidence? You know, and certainly, you know, DNA and fingerprints are fairly conclusive. But a lot of other things that people have thought, you know, was scientific evidence, like bite marks or handwriting analysis, are really not. You know, there's a large element of subjectiveness in it. And then the whole thing about eyewitness testimony, you know, 70% of people who have been freed by the Innocence Project, I think, were convicted on eyewitness evidence.
Yeah, it's not reliable.
No. What's especially not reliable, it could be pretty good if it's the initial impression. A lot of times, you know, people are shown photos by the police and kind of subtly pressured into picking one person. And then that gets settled in their mind and they're sure of it. When at the time it happened, they said, well, I just saw him for a second. So, yeah, it is interesting how all those things sort of fit in, and how in the Zodiac case, when people have a candidate, where all the evidence, you know, that points to this candidate, they emphasize, and all the evidence that doesn't, they completely ignore.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's giving a lot of people a living, I guess. It's like cottage industry.
Certainly, I'll tell you. Write a Zodiac book or write a Jack the Ripper book, and you got some good cash flow.
Yeah.
So in the book, were there any cases that particularly really surprised you that you came across?
There were a lot of interest. Well, one was certainly, I have a section called con artists, and these, and of course San Francisco has some interesting ones. And one was a Dr. Abrams, who was in fact an actual very good doctor. He went to, you know, Heidelberg University, and he wrote some classic books. And then around 1908, he came up with this idea of that electrical impulses was a big part of this. And of course, at that point, electricity was kind of a new thing. And people gave a lot of power to that. There were a lot of devices made that, you know, you plug in and that somehow made them work. And he came up with this theory that he could have this machine that could just with a sample could tell everything about you. Could tell what color hair you had, what religion you were. Anyway, and it became like a very successful business for him. And it wasn't until almost that he died that he was finally discredited. But I think that was one. Or also the one case that really interested me from just when I heard about the name of the first thing, which was the Yacht Bandits, which is, it's a great name, you know.
Yeah.
And it literally, it was true. It is these guys who had a yacht. They were actually members of the San Francisco Yacht Club. And they would sail the yacht from city to city, rob a bank, go back on the yacht, go to the next city. And these two people were incredibly talented, brilliant. They were creative writers. They could make anything. But what they loved doing was robbing banks and escaping. It's interesting that some of the most able people I've ever read about both ended up being executed for murder. But it was they're so, you know, often you read about someone or someone says, oh, this person is so smart, so talented, they could make a good living just, you know, working a regular job. But the truth is they don't want to. I mean, there's something about crime that's very, very exciting. Robbing a bank is like a performance. I can see how you would get so amped up, and that could be a thrill that could be addicting in a way.
Oh, I bet. I bet. Yes, that's why a lot of people do it. It's funny that these are bank robbers, and how you don't really hear about a lot of the bank robbers. This is a bank robbing couple, the Yacht Bandits, but yet you'll hear mm-hmm. about Bonnie and Clyde.
Well, you're right. They killed, well, of course, Bonnie and Clyde killed more people, and they were, and it was at that particular time in the 1930s when the bank robbery was big. But you're right. These people were much more interesting. Their escapes from jail were more interesting. They're just brilliant. And in fact, they were kind of the opposite of Bonnie and Clyde. Bonnie and Clyde liked to kill people. You know, they would shoot people when they didn't need to, and including police. The Yacht Bandits, to them, using a gun was an amateur's, you know, the way an amateur would do it. They wanted to rob the bank without hurting anyone, and even without having to use the gun, although they did have guns. And in fact, there was one instance when they used them. But these were people who could manufacture, while in the prison, in two different prisons, they both manufactured guns out of spare metal parts, and they manufactured bullets. You know, it's incredible how brilliant people can be if they have to do something.
Yeah, and it's funny, because I was going to say, in Bonnie and Clyde, you know, and they kind of made them look like they never killed anyone in the movies.
Yeah, they're very much glamorized. They certainly weren't, you know, Clyde did not look like Warren Beatty, I can tell you that. Yeah, they seemed sort of like goofy people who loved each other, but, you know, who shot some people. But you're right, they were very bloodthirsty.
Well, yeah, because by the end of the movie, you felt really bad when they got slaughtered there at the end, because you didn't think mm-hmm. of them as, you didn't think of them as killers. You just think that they're wild kids having a good time robbing banks. You don't really it didn't portray that. So it's kind of funny. They could have taken the Yacht Bandits and made a movie and not really have to cover that up.
It's true, and maybe they will someday. But it's sometimes the most interesting cases are not famous. Or they may be famous when they happen, but they don't stick, or no one writes a book, no one writes a bestseller, or no one makes a movie about them, and they're sort of forgotten about. It's they're often not the most interesting people, and I think, you know, in general, murderers are not sparkling wits. You know, they're not really interesting people in themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, but, you know, but they make it that way for TV, you know.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
I mean, it'd be boring if. Now, a lot of the gangsters and stuff, but, you know, people from that era, they're really kind of, they're the type of true crime people that tend to be glamorized and idolized by kids and people more than others, you know what I mean? Out of all the different types of, mm-hmm. of true crime out there, it seems to be one of the most popular.
Yeah, yeah, I think you're right. And also, you know, escape artists are the very much, you know, admired. And you can sort of understand it, you know, because it's this one person out there and they're surrounded by hundreds of police. And they have to, like, you know, walk through a sewer and make up keys to open these doors and do these incredible physical things. And even though they're, you know, in fact, they happen to be murderers, you sort of forget that. And it's like this is one person against the state. And that gives them the sort of romantic. It does turn out that most of the escape artists were bank robbers. And I think that's because that tends to attract more intelligent and more confident criminals. You really have to plan, you know, quite carefully how to rob a bank. And obviously escaping takes that same planning. But yeah, I write about a number of them. There was a guy who was, he was called the Escape King. And he was on the run. He escaped a number of times and he became kind of a hero. He didn't kill anyone. He had a cute wife and a little kid. And, you know, he would send notes while he was on the run. One time he asked President, I think it was President Hoover, says, "Give me one more chance. You know, I'll stop." And then, of course, 2 weeks later, he robbed another mail train. But yeah, there's something really kind of exciting about them.
Yeah. Now you've also got the murderous millionaire, William Thorson. So why would someone with that much money have to be a murderer? Like, or I guess it really doesn't matter. I guess that kind of brings up the point that it really doesn't matter what you own or how much you have or if you're smart or dumb or if you can write poetry. It's just if you're a murderer, you're a murderer.
Well, yeah, I think he really comes under the heading of psychopathic killer. And there are, you know, there are definite physical differences between true psychopaths and other people. And if you look at the way their brains work, there is a difference. There's much less activity in the parts of the brain that have to do with conscience and planning and things like that. And it's also interesting that all psychopaths are certainly not killers or not even criminals. And there are certain occupations, such as politicians, lawyers, who score very high in psychopathy, you know, because it gives you an advantage in the fact that you have no conscience and something is not going to stop you from doing something. And also, they tend to be very interesting and you know, charismatic. And he was, from the beginning, he was a very disturbed person. He was committed when he was still a teenager. His parents were very wealthy. His mother was kind of a socialite, and his father ran a steel company in the Midwest. But this guy really, from the very beginning, he was very twisted. And he met actually a nice a teacher who was a couple of years older than him. And but instead of her straightening him out, instead of her making him better, he made her worse. You know, so he enlisted her in a lot of the crimes. And he ended up, I mean, he murdered a number of people, including his brother, for the money. And, you know, he ended up doing a lot of things, but his wealth protected him for a while. And he certainly had a very good relationship with the leading criminal lawyers at the time, and who had tried to describe him like he had the largest armory, private armory in the history of the United States in his mansion, tons and tons of it. But his lawyer was sort of saying, well, yeah, he has a cannon on his lawn. He's like a collector, you know. he had grenade launchers, he had everything. But yeah, so I with some of them, a number of the people in the book, I really, who turn out to be serial killers, certainly they're not all psychopaths, but a number of them are, and they're pretty interesting people.
So I just wonder, in that particular case, if he was a psychopath and they had him kind of institutionalized when he was young, how did he get out? Or did they think he was treated and he was okay or fixed? Or like, how does something like that happen?
Well, he was very smart. And he intimidated, I think, his parents and other people. And when he was a kid, yeah, he was committed, but then he escaped and he kind of made a deal with his parents so that he saw a psychiatrist and he got an allowance. And, you know, he was able to be normal for a while and wait until he started. He kept waiting to inherit money. That's what his game was. And he did a number of things to do that. And once he had the money, then he got even more dangerous. But, you know, people can act, and it's, if you have money, it's easier to stay out of jail. Yeah. And sometimes it takes a long time for there to be enough charges, and you post bail and you get out and you post bail again. So it takes years sometimes. And I'm surprised that more people don't know about him, because he was quite astounding. And it's funny, his wife wrote a book which had the title, "It Gave Everybody Something to Do," which is
wow.
Interesting thing.
Well, yeah, especially someone so rich. How many did he kill in all?
Right. I would say, you know, I don't know for exact, I would say about five. He killed his brother. He killed a number. He killed some people in the mansion itself. He killed the guy who killed his brother. You know, the person he hired to kill.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
His brother. And actually, there's a very good chance that he was one of the most famous cases in the Chicago area in history. It was the murder of, I think it was Charles Percy's daughter. Percy was a senator from Chicago, very wealthy guy, living in the most expensive suburb in the state, and his daughter was murdered, and the murder has never been solved. But when you look back at it, and with some of the evidence that's come up, there are a lot of good reasons for believing that Thorson was the killer.
Yeah. Wow. Well, the more money you have, the more freedom you get.
Yes, yes.
Well, it's, you know, you can buy the lawyers, you can buy all the top stuff, so, you know, gives you a lot of opportunity.
Well, you know, if you're poor, you're crazy. If you're rich, you're eccentric. That's how it works out a lot of times.
Yeah. Oh, another one. I like this. Big Bertha Heyman. I love names like that.
She was great. She shows up in San Francisco around 1880. She goes to the rabbi of one of the biggest congregations, and she introduces herself as a widow who is Jewish, but inherited, I think it was $300,000 from her Christian husband. $300,000 was like 30 or 40 million today. And she said that, you know, I married outside of the faith the first time, but I really want to marry a Jewish man this time. And I'm looking for a, you know, an established, upright, you know, religious, well-off Jewish man. And I'll pay $1,000 to find this person. So she starts getting introduced to the sort of wealthy congregants. And his brother-in-law, who was a wealthy merchant, the rabbi's brother-in-law, falls in love with her, despite the fact she was called Big Bertha for a reason. She weighed close to 300 pounds. And in the newspaper, she was often described as elephantine or compared to a battleship. But she had this, you know, she had this incredible charisma, and he fell in love with her, and he gave her jewelry. A lot of people gave her jewelry. She wrote a check out to the congregation, and then she disappeared, and her check bounced, and the guy, her to-be husband, started investigating and went to the police and described this woman. And she went to, there was a very famous detective in San Francisco who listened to the description of her, and then he turned and took a book out of the bookcase and turned to page 209 and pointed to the picture and said, "Is this her?" And it was. The book was Professional Criminals of America. It was a book written by the chief of police of New York. It's a very famous book, Thomas Burns. And she was Bella. She was known to be one of the most, one of the cleverest criminals in the United States. And she was able to just really con people consistently. And then what happened was that she was hired by a producer because it was so interesting to have this person. And she had this other career, and she would give lectures about her life, and then she would sing one of two songs that she knew. And later on, she became a star actress, and she became known as an actress who couldn't act, a singer who couldn't sing, and a dancer who couldn't sing, who couldn't dance. And the fact that she was so bad was a great draw for some reason. You know, she went on in that area for a long time. So she was just, you know, she's very funny, you know, from our point of view. She's charming. It's a great story. Of course, if you were one of the people who had gotten conned by her, you probably wouldn't think she was this way. But she was quite an unusual person.
Well, it sounds like it. And what she could get, what was that said in the Woodward Gardens? She had 18,000 people see her.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And what it said about her, she had the reputation, this is Thomas Burns from the New York Police Department. She has the reputation for being one of the smartest confidence women in America. And it was kind of written very admiredly. And she also said that the moment I discover a man's a fool, I let him drop. But I delight in getting into the confidence and pockets of men who think they can't be skinned. It ministers to my intellectual pride. Which is a great line. But the truth is that if a man was a fool, she'd also con him. So, yeah, she was quite... Actually, she was once in a play. There's a character, a famous character in San Francisco known as Oofty Goofty. And his talent was that he felt no pain. And you could kick him, you know, for a dime. You could hit him with a bat for a quarter. This became like a big deal when people would go to the Barbary Coast. They'd want to, you know, hit Oofty. So he and Big Bertha were hired by a theater to do Romeo and Juliet. But they had to do it differently because there was no way that she could fit into the balcony. So the balcony scene was played with him in the balcony and her on the ground. And, you know, it was a big hit, but he was kind of rough. She quit it after a few performances, and her acting career ended when she was in a play called Mazeppa. It was a very famous 19th century play, and in this play, the heroine is strapped to a donkey, and you know various things happen. So she was strapped to a real donkey on stage, and the donkey and her fell into the orchestra pit and wiped out the 2/3 of the orchestra. So go figure.
Yeah.
These are interesting people.
So she was mainly a con person. That was her big thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. She was a con person who became like an actress, but basically she was a con person, and she had done it many, many times and for long periods. Now, I understand, I've read something about she might have even been a wrestler at one point. And then there was another point where she and a woman of similar size engaged in a horse race, which was, another big hit. She was quite a celebrity in her own way.
Wow. Never interesting. There's so much great history. Oh, and in the book, you've also covered, I guess, the Queen of Grudges. Now, what was that? Tried to poison an entire town.
Yes. Yes. It was this woman, who was, let's put it this way. If holding grudges was an Olympic event, she would have won the gold medal. For, you know, she was she lived in Northern California, and she was always suing people. Basically, she married a wealthy miner. And at one point, she went away for a few months, came back with a child who she claimed was his. And he died suddenly. And she sued to get his estate. She got involved in a number of lawsuits, and also with his brother. And when she had a grudge. She acted on it. So the attorney who was against her in this earlier case, she harassed him for the next 10 years. She planned and she raised this kid as kind of her criminal. So she planned, she didn't like the town that she was in, so she poisoned their water supply. But fortunately, the current took it in another place. So just a few, I think animals died. And then she continually was fighting with people. She would burn down some of her cottages for the insurance. Anyway, she blew up, or she had her son blow up a judge's house. So this was, you know, her entire life was doing this. And she had the entire legal community in Northern California on edge until she finally was convicted. And actually, she ended up being sent to a mental hospital. and her son, I mean, this is, he was a 16-year-old. And he was doing all these things under her spell. And fortunately, when he was out of her control, he actually turned into a normal person.
How do you recover?
I don't know. Well, it was, but it's just so many interesting things. You know, there's a lot more detail in the book, and she was like a real fashion plate also. Quite entrancing. Some of these people are really can be quite humorous, at least some parts of them. But the nerve of some people or the craziness of some people. Well, there was a guy in the book. He was known as the. I'm trying to remember his name. He poisoned his wives, and what he used was buttermilk. He was known as the buttermilk poisoner, and he had this whole routine where he would romance an older woman, an older wealthy woman, and then take her out of the state to a hotel and poison her with buttermilk. And, you know, doctors who come to hotels are not the brightest. And the doctor would say it was some kind of heart disease. And then he would ship the body to another state, have it cremated, and destroy all the evidence. They were never actually able to convict him of murder, but they did convict him of some other things, which took him out of circulation. So, you know, there's just a lot of fascinating criminals from San Francisco, most of whom you really don't know about. There was this woman, Dorothy, who shot her mother when she was 16, and she created a new disease. And she also influenced world literature. Now, the new disease was jazz mania, because at that time, a lot of the ministers thought that jazz was driving people crazy, driving kids to do these things. It's, you know, we heard all this stuff about rock and roll in the 1950s. It really hasn't changed.
Yeah.
And F. Scott Fitzgerald followed this case closely, and it became almost a plot line in one of his books. So it was so unusual that someone of that age would kill their father. Now I don't want to say it's normal, but it's certainly not unheard of. So it brought up a whole lot of other things in terms of people who believed in eugenics, you know, saying, well, this, someone like her is morally insane, and she's feeble-minded. That was a big term in those days, and that she should be committed to an institution. So, it was a huge, huge sensation at the time, and she went on to have not a great life, but I don't want to get into it too much.
No, you know, it's just enticing to get people to read the book. Now, you also do a crime tour in San Francisco. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. I do two crime tours. One is of the Barbary Coast. Now, the Barbary Coast was the most dangerous part of San Francisco for probably 40 years. And it was a unique criminal district that was the scene of more viciousness and depravity, but possessed more glamour than any other area on the American continent. So it's this, it's this glorious depravity that attracts so many people to San Francisco. And it was that way because of Shanghai. It was, the big business in that part of the city was Shanghaiing sailors, which means that you knock someone out, give them a drink or something, put them on a ship, while they're unconscious, sell them to the captain of that ship for the first 3 months' wage. And this person wakes up and he's on this boat, and his choice is work on the boat or swim. The area became really a magnet, and it became even a kind of a tourist sensation. A lot of famous people would come to San Francisco to see this, and a lot of the dance crazes of the early 20th century came out of this. And of course, Chinatown was also it was very dangerous. It was dangerous for Chinese because of the importance of the Tongs, and a lot of this was because Chinese were sort of banned from coming to the United States at that time because of various laws. But there were always these Tongs controlling things, and there were a lot. There's even a crime map that's done by the board of the city, and you can still get it. It's a color-coded map of Chinatown, which notates with color the gambling places, houses of Chinese prostitution, white prostitution, opium places. It's quite fascinating. So those are two different tours that I give.
Wow, that's pretty interesting. Now, do you have a website for that, for the tours?
Yes, it's called crookstour.com. And okay. I got that from, crookstour.com. And that was an idea of my mentor, a friend, Kevin Mullen, who was the deputy police chief of San Francisco and who became a crime historian. And he came up with that idea, and it ended up being a walking tour.
Wow. Sounds pretty interesting. We'll have that posted on our website as well, so people can find it easier. Now your book, it's available on Amazon, and I would imagine any bookstores, if they don't have it, they can order it.
Absolutely.
And do you have a website yourself for your books or for anything else? Or
No, I have the Crooks Tour website. I have a Facebook page for Notorious San Francisco, but I am putting up a website for the book.
Okay, fantastic.
And I'll be talking at a number of places, speaking at a number of bookstores in San Francisco and Northern California.
Oh, that'll be good. That'll be fun. So you're going to go around to the bookstores and just kind of present your book or talk about the San Francisco?
Yeah, I think talk about it, maybe read a little bit of it, and answer questions, because I'm certainly knowledgeable about bad things that went on in this town for a long time and things to interest people.
Well, I didn't think anything bad ever happened in San Francisco.
Yeah, it's a very dull place.
Quiet place. Yeah. Go knit and
exactly. That's where retirees come instead of going to Arizona. They come to San Francisco.
Yeah. Do you have any influences yourself as far as crime, like writers or anything like that?
Well, I do. I am interested in the con artists. That's one area that's interesting to me. And there's also some of the unsolved crimes. Certainly there's the Zodiac, and there's a couple of other cases that I think are quite interesting. So, But I'm open to all crime. Let me put it that way.
Well, there's plenty out there. Lots of crimes to find. That's
yes, yes.
Are you going to continue writing about this? Is this going to be?
Oh, sure. I think I will. Yeah, I think I will. I find it, you know, just very interesting, and that it's kind of a way to look at the world through the lens of crimes, and often they're very connected to issues that are going on in the world. And yeah, they're great stories. I like stories, and that's, you know, cops and criminals are both really good storytellers. Let me put it that way.
Yeah,
and obviously, so do other people. So,
are you working on another book right now, or are you giving it a break?
I'm working on some pieces. I don't know if they're going to end up in a book or not, but yeah, I am back to writing again now that the book is out, and we'll see where that goes. I like to create a deadline for myself. That's how work, at least for me, gets done. And it will probably end up as a book.
Wow, sounds great. Well, it's been a great interview, and I'm glad you had the time to come on the show.
Thank you very much.
The book, of course, we're talking about is Notorious San Francisco, True Tales of Crime, Passion, and Murder. Our guest has been Paul Drexler. Thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you so much for the opportunity.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.